Down the Up Staircase tells the story of one Harlem family across three generations, connecting its journey to the historical and social forces that transformed Harlem over the past century. Bruce D. Haynes, my guest today, and his wife and co-author Sima Selovich capture the tides of change that pushed blacks forward through the 20th century. The Great Migration, the Harlem Renaissance, the early civil rights victories, the Black Power and Black Arts movements. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Oh, thanks, Terry.
So in many ways, your family really defied the odds. All four great-grandparents on your father's side owned land in the South as early as 1880. How did that specific piece of your history influence you? Or did you know that?
Well, you know, I think land was important because it was a catalyst for my grandparents' education. On my father's side came, my paternal side came from Lowndes County, and my paternal side came from Pine Bluff. But both sides of the family owned land, and that provided a catalyst for my father's parents becoming highly educated at the turn of the century. My grandfather migrated to New York and went to Columbia University. And not only did he graduate with a PhD from Columbia University, but he also founded the National Urban League.
And he is George Edmund Haynes.
That's correct. George Edmund Haynes, and he actually worked with the E.B. Du Bois in the Atlanta School, which was the first school of professional sociologists, and he was mentored by Du Bois. And in fact, his strategy for, Du Bois founded the NAACP, and my grandfather founded the Urban League, that the two organizations were actually conceived of as a dual strategy by the two men.
Just amazing. And your grandmother, Elizabeth Ross Haynes, a noted children's author of the Harlem Renaissance, also a prominent social scientist, it would seem that your family would have really had the world in their palm. What happened? Because you start the book with how run down the home was.
Well, you know, by the 70s, the house had become run down. But, you know, the story begins with my grandfather and grandmother purchasing property back in the 1930s in the Harlem community. Mm-hmm. And that might have provided, you know, real wealth to the family had it not been in a segregated neighborhood. Mm. So my father, who went on to become a social worker, used those properties to finance the education for myself and my brothers back in the 70s. But those houses that he sold, those brownstones that he had owned, only brought thousands of dollars and just barely financed our education. And but if those homes had been in white, unsegregated neighborhoods, or should I say, you know, in white-only neighborhoods, they would have been worth millions of dollars. And so our family trajectory would have looked very different had it not been simply for the fact of segregation.
That's just crazy. You know, you look back on that at this time in history, and you look back at that and think, what in the world were people thinking?
Well, you could look back in history today and maybe say, what are people thinking today? Because a lot of the segregation that existed then still remains within our neighborhoods and in our institutions and our schools, et cetera.
It does. It does. And, you know, really, it crosses color lines in terms of in neighborhoods when people first got here. And perhaps that's because of language barriers, but it was, you know, the Irish and the Italian and the Jewish neighborhoods, and it was all very, very separated.
Well, you know, I wanted to capture that real American saga of mobility. Mm-hmm. And which is a very similar saga as the groups you just mentioned. But one of the things that I think was so different for African Americans was the level of segregation and the direct impact it's had economically on families. And so when I look at the two, in fact, let me tell you a story. When at the first book reading that my wife and I did here in Davis, a close friend of mine, a retired emeritus faculty member, a mathematician, who happens to be Jewish and from the East Coast, he came up to me and he said, you know, I had always thought our people were the same. And he said, no, but I now realize you folks had it harder. Hmm? And for me, it was really a gratifying statement because it really, I wanted to show how there was this sort of added tax in effect, yeah. You know, despite all the normal challenges that we have for mobility, that on top of that, there's this layer of racial inequality that compounds every other inequality that exists in our society.
Yeah, yeah. And we still haven't figured out why, have we?
I think we have. I mean, for me, a lot of it boils down to political will. I mean, we all know what makes for successful schools. Wealthy people send their kids to elite prep schools and right. boarding schools, and we look at the resources that they have there, and we don't wonder why they want to send their kids there.
Yeah.
And, I would think poor people would like to send their kids to a comparable school, but they can't. And so we really build inequality in at a very fundamental level, at the neighborhood level. Mm. And so if I'm a poor kid, black or white, and with little education in my neck of the woods, it's going to be really tough to compete out there.
Mm. And how did that work for you as you did go to elite schools? What was that like as a black man going to what I guess I'm assuming, and maybe I shouldn't, is white schools?
Well, I was lucky. I came through in the early 1970s. It was progressive era. I happened to be in Manhattan. I was going to predominantly Jewish prep schools. And I have to say, I was well received. I had lots of friends. I had girlfriends. I went to people's country homes. And in fact, I grew up thinking that I was living the kind of Martin Luther King ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got older and as I shifted institutions and, you know, I started experiencing more overt racism in college. As you got into dating age with young ladies, the parents seemed less interested in you dating them as they had when you were 12 and 13, when it was really cute. And so things definitely changed over time. But my experiences were very positive. Unlike my brother George, for example, who came through just 10 years earlier, he was also in prep school, but he experienced a lot of racism, had very few friends, became somewhat radicalized, you might say, by his experiences, and ended up joining the Nation of Islam as a young adult.
Yeah.
So we had very different experiences in the same city, coming out of the same neighborhood.
And I want to remind folks, we're talking with Bruce D. Haynes. He is the author, co-author, I should say, of the book Down the Up Staircase, about his family, three generations of his family in Harlem. And what was that like for you to write your family's history, reliving some very painful memories?
Well, you know, it was a challenge. And one of the reasons I have a co-author is that I wanted to reach deep into the family. And I knew that my own personal instincts was to be guarded, both in terms of how my family raised me, but also my training as a sociologist. We like to qualify everything. And But I really wanted to write an organic true story that was honest. And so my co-author, Sima Solovich, who happened to be my wife, who knew my parents and knows my brother and had been in the house. And so she was really able to push me towards that level of honesty that I probably would have avoided on my own.
Yeah, well, I could see why. And, you know, I would like you to tell our listeners a little bit about your mom, because Daisy sounds like a rather incredible woman.
She was. I had the best mother in the world, I have to say. she saw me as, nothing but a star. Everything I did was going to work out wonderful, and she pushed me on to perform when I was really young. She used to, she's quite fashionable, and so she wanted to shop at places like Bertolf Goodman and Saxon Avenue, despite that, we were living on social worker salaries, and, but her taste was aspiring to the upper classes, and I guess maybe the best story to capture is she ended up passing away from cancer, and back in 1998. The week before, she was headed into the hospital, and she was pretty sick at this point with a cancer that was rapidly developing, and she was heading off for experimental therapy. And she wanted to go to Saxon Avenue. And so we took her down in a wheelchair to have her nails done. And in fact, to replace a bathrobe that my wife had purchased for her, but was a little below the quality that my mom really wanted. And so she had to take it back and get a better robe. She wanted to look good when she went into Mount Sinai. And so we wheeled her through. And she waved like the queen to the dozens of women who she had known over the years who worked behind the counters, because she'd met everybody and they did favors for her and would, buy products on their discount, and then she'd bring them gifts later. And so she had a real, real way with people. Yeah. And it was quite the event that last Saturday, taking her there for her goodbye.
She sounds like a delightful woman, and unfortunately your parents didn't seem to delight in each other a whole heck of a lot later on.
Well, they did at first apparently, but I missed that part.
Yeah,
I was I came late in life. I was a surprise baby in 1960, and my father had been married back during World War II. Mm-hmm. And when he met my mother after the war, he didn't tell her. Mm. So this little fact came out late in their relationship and really created a ripple in their relationship during the period of my childhood. So I grew up with a lot of arguments taking place, and that probably pushed me towards listening to a lot of loud funk and rock and roll so I could drown out their arguing. And so there was a real impact from that event.
Yeah. We're talking with Bruce D. Haynes. He is the co-author of Down the Upstaircase. One other thing that I'm thinking about, how would you see today's relations among the Black middle class and lower classes? Is there, there seemed to be, while you were growing up, more of a distinction between the classes of Blacks, the same as there is for white people, really. What do you see, any shift?
Well, I think the Black middle class is we're the canary in a coal mine for the American middle class. Mm-hmm. And so the kinds of conditions that the Black middle class experienced in the 70s and 80s, requiring two wage earners, struggling to maintain their middle class standard of living. Now we're seeing white families struggling with the same challenges. And so we see a real erosion of the middle class, a real inability of the middle class to pass their status on to their kids. And so we really see that taking place with the Great Recession, where half of black wealth disappeared overnight.
As a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, your studies are racial and ethnic relations and urban communities. Have you found your community? And how would you define that?
Have I found my community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had mentioned in your book about, searching for the community. There were differences in the color of, in the shades of skin color. And I was just curious as to the community that you feel most...
I live in a wonderful community here, highly educated, but predominantly white.
Okay.
I think the challenge is, in fact, that in order to live in a black neighborhood, I will suffer economic consequences for doing so, precisely because of segregation. So if there is a way that we actually have integrated neighborhoods, of which they seem to be very few of them, that ideal could be achieved. But the reality is, if I want to send my kids to better schools, if I want to have better amenities, the chances are they are not in the black neighborhood. And that has to do with the historic way in which black middle-class neighborhoods were built.
So what do we do to change that? How do we... Do we address that in terms of getting more money into the neighborhoods so that?
Well, yes, in fact, and maybe mm-hmm. what your question makes me think of is the fact that we're about to have a Congress that will loosen up banking regulations to once again put the average homeowner in jeopardy.
Yeah,
because that's what wiped out the wealth in the first place during the Great Recession, mm-hmm. was the fact that predatory lending was overwhelmingly concentrated in black and Latino neighborhoods across the nation.
Yeah.
And we can see that as a microcosm right here in Sacramento. And so there are still neighborhoods that are just coming back from that recession.
Compared
to my neighborhood here in Davis, which is predominantly white, and because I'm in a college town, home values stayed relatively stable.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. The way we're headed now, it's scary.
So maybe I should follow that up with so credit is what I'm trying to drive at.
Right.
The fact that people cannot get credit and get credit under fair conditions.
Right.
This is the fundamental characteristic of segregation. It's driven by credit, and in a sense, it's that denial of credit which perpetuates this race-based inequality throughout the nation.
Yeah, and ridiculous interest rates that are charged to people who can't afford to do it anyway.
Precisely. So you already have a depressed wage, mm-hmm. now you're living in a neighborhood where your home values are depressed because people don't want them, but you're also paying a higher interest rate on your loan.
Right.
And you might be doing the same for your car loan as well, because, there tends to be added higher interest rates that blacks tend to pay for even car loans. So your wealth is being sucked away for racial reasons on multiple levels.
Well, to wrap things up, Bruce, I do want to ask you what that was like to go back into your family home years later after your parents were both gone and sort of dismantle what was there.
Oh, that was probably one of the most difficult events in my life. One of the things I describe in the book is the way in which my parents collected things, and the word hoarding didn't exist then, but I would imagine that's what we would have called it. And so there were a couple of generations of both precious goods like antique bookcases, as well as, you know, deteriorating rugs and basements that had been there for 30 years that should have been thrown away. And it was all there mixed together. And so it was a journey, both through history of the family, but also through my own childhood. And so it was a challenge. It was a challenge. And it actually got to a point where some of my neighbors who were helping me, I cleaned out much of what I thought was valuable, and emotionally I just turned it over to them. And in fact, to this day, I regret one of the neighbors who who helped me clean out the house. I had a rifle my father had collected from World War II, which had come from Japan. And I let this person take it, and I thought, oh, that's one thing I should have held on to, this collectible rifle. But, you know, I was so overwhelmed at the point, I just thought, you know, just take it away. I can't handle it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And how many years has that been?
That was 1998. We sold the house.
Okay.
But I say I did salvage some things from the home that are quite amazing. So, for instance, I have a 5'8" tall, I guess it's about 12-13 feet long, beveled glass bookcase that used to sit in the hallway of the home.
Wow.
It has the same carvings that the wood work in the house had from the original architect of this turn of the century brownstone.
Wow.
So I had this piece sitting in my living room here in Davis, and I gotta say, I've never seen anything quite like it.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have some of the good memories as well, of course, of your family. And we appreciate your time, Bruce. It's quite the memoir, Down the Upstaircase, a real study in the Harlem era, three generations of one family. Bruce, thank you for your time. And I suspect we'll be talking with you again as you write your next book.
Oh, Terry, well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.